Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, back here with you at our regular time of 6 p.m. on Wednesdays, Pacific. I know you're busy and you have lots of things to do, so let me thank you for your time and your attention, and especially this week for your votes and encouragement, because, you know, it was many of you who encouraged me to send in an audition tape to Oprah's new network and see if it's in the cards that, you know, I get a show about discussing challenging topics that empower and uplift women. You know, no celebrity gossip recipes, how to unclutter your life shows for me. No, I don't want to, you know, talk about the bread and circus stuff. I'm more interested in the sort of things we talk about here on Voices of the Sacred Feminine, like I said in the audition tape. You know, because all of that silly stuff that, you know, that seems to pervade the media, you know, feels like it's just distractions to keep us from the real issues. So please, if you haven't voted already, I need your vote, and you can vote more than once, I find out. And I'm way behind. Most people started their vote gathering in March, so I'm really playing catch up. But, you know, if it's meant to be or something good is meant to come out of it, so be it. I'm just sort of going with the flow. And I'm going to keep asking for your votes because, you know, it's like getting a job. You have to focus your intention at your altar and by pounding the pavement. But I've also released this to the wisdom of the universe. So, you know, I'll keep saying it. Go vote and vote again. And it's not hard to find. You can Google Oprah's network website. When you're there, you'll see that she's looking for a new host. Click on that section of the website, and then you can browse all the audition tapes. Now, you probably don't want to look at all the tapes. There's probably 2,500. You can find me really quickly. There's a box, and you can just put my name in the box, Karen Tate. So please do, and if you like what you see in the audition tape, if you believe in my vision, please vote for me and get all your friends and family to vote too, because you know what? This is maybe our chance to get topics important to us on mainstream television. Imagine that. And I can't forget, I want to give a shout out to Leah Scallion. It's her music you were listening to at the show's opening, that unusual piece, very ethereal sounding, was called Star Song, and it's from her CD called Song of Sirius. And I played it today sort of in tribute to all the animals, the wildlife in the Gulf, you know, the birds, the porpoises, the fish. It sounded like porpoises to me. And so anyway, a tribute to them and their suffering and passing, no doubt, with this devastation. So I know most of you listen from the archives, but I still remind you and invite you to call in and comment during What's the Buzz later on in the show, or certainly call in and speak to our guest, Reverend Shirley Rank. She's the author of Cakes for the Queen of Heaven, which is part of the Unitarian Universalist series on feminist theology. And our topic tonight is Cakes for the Queen of Heaven, Reclaiming Women's Religious History. And if you do want to call in, the number is 718-766-4662. You'll see it on your computer screen. And I want to announce my special summer series I've planned to celebrate my first anniversary here on Blog Talk, although I'm actually coming up on 3 years total doing Voices of the Sacred Feminine. And the three series I have planned for the summer are Sacred Knowledge, Sacred Destinations, and the third is Men and Goddess. Now, tonight's guest, of course, is part of the Sacred Knowledge series, as is next week's guest. Next week's guest is Helen Hai-Suk Huang, and her topic is Discovering the Great Goddess Mago of East Asia. And also at the bottom of the hour that night, Sandy Kirkpatrick is going to be coming on the show about 6:45. We're going to talk about human trafficking and updates on the relief efforts in Haiti, which seems to have just totally dropped from the news because Sandy has actually been there and volunteered very recently for some time. Then on June 23rd, we have Marguerite Rogoglioso. She's going to kick off our Sacred Destinations series discussing Tunisia and the Amazons. June 30th, we have Stephen Geringer from the Joseph Campbell Foundation staff. He's going to kick off Men and Goddess. And in July, Men and Goddess continues with John Lamb Lash, Razit Erringer calling in from Turkey, and Poke Runyon, who I'm sure will be talking about Astarte. So stay tuned in through the summer and catch these special shows, including my interview with Margot Adler. And because you like it so much, I got to let those bees out of my bonnet about once every week. So after our interview, we'll get into our What's the Buzz segment. And our topics for tonight will be Agora, the movie about the astronomer and philosopher Hypatia that opened in New York and Los Angeles, was very good. And the good news is it's going to be opening to a national audience soon. But more on that and why they didn't release it nationally when it was such a huge hit in Europe last year, later on in the show. From the Daily Beast, we have an article, kind of tragic, but we need to hear it. Are those oil-soaked birds in the Gulf Coast really better off dead? Statistics are showing lesbians make great moms, especially for teens. We're going to talk about that. And Cardinal Roger Mahoney, who hails from Los Angeles, is about to retire, and he may actually face federal indictment for his involvement in the pedophile priest cover-ups. And the New York Times' Maureen Dowd had an article I want to share called Dress to Distract about a woman who claims she was fired from Citibank for looking too sexy. I don't know, sounds like maybe the virtue police are stalking the halls of the Chrysler Center. And remember, we talked about the red spiral dance idea that was burning up Facebook. Well, I have a comment from someone who wrote me I think you'll enjoy. So stay with me after my interview with Reverend Shirley Rank, or call in and talk to me and Shirley about what's on your mind. But without further delay, let me turn my attention to tonight's guest, Shirley Rank, and I'll start with telling you a bit about her. Here's her bio. Shirley is a crone of wisdom and power who has touched the lives of many women through her writing and teaching. The Reverend Shirley Ann Rank brings both personal and professional insight to her work. Trained in education, psychology, and ministry, she's drawn upon all these disciplines, as well as her various personal lives as wife, mother, and single parent, to create the female spiritual journey contained in Cakes for the Queen of Heaven. While working full-time and birthing and raising two daughters and two sons, Shirley managed to earn her master's degree in religious education from Drew University, an MA in clinical psychology from City College of New York, a PhD in urban school psychology from Fordham University, and her Master of Divinity from Star King School for the ministry in Berkeley. She's been an educator and a licensed psychologist in California, as well as an ordained minister in the Unitarian Universalist Association. She's worked in hospitals, clinics, and a county jail for women, as well as in private practice. And after many years of service as a UU minister, she'll soon retire and live in the Bay Area, where she plans to devote her time to writing, speaking, and being an activist for women's issues and environmental concerns. Well, Shirley, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, first of all, let me ask you, did I pronounce your last name properly? Is it Rank?
Yes. Yes, that's right.
Okay.
The man that I was married to, my second marriage, that was his name, and he always pronounced it Runk, but it's been easier for everybody to spell by pronouncing it Rank, so I pronounce it Rank.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks. I'm glad we you know, because I forgot to ask you before the show, and I don't want to go the rest of the hour saying your name incorrectly. So thank you for that. But, you know, it is such an honor to have you on the show to talk about the Cakes for the Queen of Heaven, and I have to thank you from the bottom of my heart for writing this. You know, I've been teaching it at the Goddess Temple of Orange County since January, both session, you know, the first part and the second part, and we've been doing like two classes a month, and it's just been incredible. And you know, it's not a bunch of hype or hyperbole, you know, in the materials where women say over and over again that this curriculum changed their lives, because I can see it in my own students. You know, they have these aha moments. And, you know, they'll come to class and they'll say, you know what, I'm looking at everything on the news differently now, you know.
Yeah.
So I just want to say thank you, first of all, because
well,
I think this is really important what you did.
Well, you know, my intention originally was to connect women's personal lives and their personal issues with the archaeological and historical material, which I call the other half of the story. We've only been taught the men's half for the most part in our educational system. And I got very interested in ancient goddesses and all kinds of wonderful writings that we've never been taught about. And anyway, I, having worked in psychology, I was concerned that to connect that with where women were living in their lives. So at the time I first put it together, we were all, you know, the whole society was concerned about being as thin as possible, you know, looking like these scrawny models that you see on TV.
Mm-hmm. And the first session is about reclaiming your body as sacred.
Exactly. And I wanted to connect that with the very, very, very ancient figures that they discovered in the caves, which go back like 50,000 years before the Common Era, not 5,000, 50,000.
Mm-hmm.
And they were large women, and, you know, they weren't skinny little things. They were, you know, impressive figures.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted women to get a sense of that, that not everybody has to be thin, not everybody you know, is the same, but we need to be strong figures.
Absolutely.
And you know, in the beginning, when I taught that first session, I couldn't get anybody to say anything good about their bodies. You know, several different times I taught it, I thought, you know, don't you like anything about your body?
Well,
but
you know, we've been so
changed.
Programmed. I mean, the programming has been pervasive.
But that, I have to say, that has changed over the years, and I'm really glad to see it. Now, you know, almost everybody will say, well, I really like my hair, or I really like the way my eyes are, or, you know, whatever. But that wasn't so 30 years ago.
Wow. Well, and you know, and I bet it's still hard for larger women, or maybe women who aren't as well endowed in the breast area. I bet it's still hard for those women to really look in the mirror and like themselves.
That's
you know?
Right. It still is. Yeah.
Well,
it's changed a little. It's changed in some ways, and some things are good, and some things are not. I think we now have an epidemic of obesity, so.
Yeah, well, there's that, too.
But
well,
I keep saying, you know, it's health and well-being that we want. It's not being skinny or heavy or any of those things. It's being healthy and strong. So.
Well, and you know, Shirley, I think so much about this is important simply because we're talking about it. You know, we're giving, you know, I can see that in the women, you know. They'll start to open up. You know, it's maybe stuff they've been thinking but dared not say, you know.
Right.
And it's almost like it gives them permission. It's liberating, you know. It's liberating for them to be able to see themselves differently, just to be able to say, you know what they're telling me out there is not the norm. You know,
mm-hmm.
This is just some patriarchal idea of beauty, and I don't have to buy into it, you know.
Exactly.
Well, It's funny, we just got finished doing the class on Sarah the priestess, and I have to tell you, that was a brilliant lesson plan you wrote, because to have the women actually write Sarah's voice back into that, that passage where, Abraham has taken Isaac up to be, sacrificed to God.
But I can't claim credit for it because I stole it. Many, many years ago, I went to a women's spirituality conference, and there was a young woman rabbi there, and she had her workshop. She had us do that. And I was at that time putting together the original cakes for the Queen of Heaven and wondering what on earth I was going to do for some of these sessions. And I said, aha, there's one session. So I don't have her name in front of me, but I wish I did. But she was the one who designed that. And
well, I was so proud of the women because some of them actually just rewrote it, which was beautiful. And, and some of them actually acted it out, in sort of a little skit. And they actually, hit Abraham with Isaac on the ground with a knife to his throat. And it was funny, without actually even, the groups collaborating with each other, it was funny because they all had very similar themes that ran through the story. Abraham definitely got banished, for even thinking of doing such a horrific thing. All of the women just somehow came to that, that idea. And it was always the goddess, not the angel, who actually stopped him. Those were common themes that, that actually ran through. And what really felt liberating, too, for the women was it gave them a safe space to really just vent about this horrible Yahweh. He was somebody that you wouldn't want for a friend or a lover or a brother or a husband, much less a god. And why did Abraham make this pact with this horrible god? Was some of the women actually said, I don't think Yahweh was a god. I think he was really a demon. That was horrible what he put Abraham through. But, you just really got the sense that, they hadn't been able to say these kinds of things before.
Well, that's true. We haven't been taught anything about the other half of the story. We haven't known anything other than the biblical God, in our general culture. I was absolutely shocked. I went through our whole educational system, and beyond. And when I realized that the Parthenon, the great temple in Athens, had actually been built for a goddess. I had never known that, or it hadn't registered with me. And that the religion of Demeter and Persephone was a mother-daughter religion that lasted for over 1,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, I had sort of heard of these figures, but I had never connected it in that sense that here was this beautiful temple built to honor the divine as female, and here was a religion, not the father and the son, which is what we're used to, but the mother and the daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I don't suppose it shocks anybody anymore now that we've made some of this, gotten some of this information out there. But for me, it was a real awakening. Oh, yes, there is another way to look at this.
Well, and I think some of this stuff is really in plain sight, but we don't think about it. We just see it the way we've been programmed to see it, and we don't, unfortunately, don't always use some critical thinking. I mean, like, for instance, the Demeter-Persephone myth, when I was teaching it, we sort of extrapolated the intent, I think, of the lesson. And besides the fact that the goddess affirms healthy relationships between mothers and daughters, we took it a step further and we said, mm-hmm. since we are all daughters and we are all mothers in some sense, whether we create flesh and blood children or we create movements or books or ideas
right.
or whatever, then goddess is affirming healthy relationships between women. You know?
Right.
Yeah, so it was, we've been having a lot of fun with this.
And that whole thing, you know, the mother-daughter or relationships among women was the another source of enormous tension for women in their lives. And so that's the basis for one of the other sessions going on. Mother-daughter, you know. So.
Well, Shirley, how did this, I mean, obviously it makes so much sense now, you know, now that it's done and it's put together. I mean, I know when I started learning about Goddess 20, 25 years ago, I didn't know about Cape for the Queen of Heaven. So I took the long way around finding out about this stuff. I mean, Rhianne Eisler's Chalice in the Blade, Marilyn
yes.
Stone,
yes.
When God Was a Woman, and countless other books. But this sort of gives it all to you really in a really wonderful condensed package. But I'm wondering, how did it come to be that this curriculum was written?
Well, tell you a couple of things about that. I was at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. I had finished my studies, but I was waiting for my daughters to finish high school. So I was working in one of the offices there at the Graduate Theological Union. And Jacob Needleman came into the office one day, and he had gotten a great big grant to study new religious movements in America. And he's since written books on it. But anyway, he was dispensing small grants to students to go interview various gurus and that sort of thing. And I turned around and I said to him, do you have anybody looking into the goddess movement, which is beginning to be very big among the women? I said, I just came back from a goddess conference in Santa Cruz, and it was like 500 people there, and speakers and rituals. And I said, this is very important to the women. And he said back to me, if you will write a paper and teach a class, we'll give you a grant of $1,000. And I, being, you know, an impoverished student with two daughters in school, I said, I'll be glad to do it. And so that was the beginning of my collecting materials about the whole goddess movement among women. And this had to have been about 1979. Then in the Unitarian Universalist denomination, in 1977, the women had passed a resolution at our big General Assembly demanding that we revise our theology, saying women were being overlooked and undervalued, and demanding that we change our theologies and our language and root out sexist language and assumptions and so forth. And the resolution passed, and some of the women said, it passed, and it's great, but I don't think they realize what they passed. But anyway, one of the results of that was that a woman on the staff in our headquarters in Boston knew that I had been working on collecting a lot of this material on feminist theology, and she called me and said, would you be willing to write a study guide in feminist theology? And I said, oh, I'd love to do that. And anyway, the more we talked about it and we got together, and the more we talked about it, the bigger it got. And it turned out to be the original Cakes for the Queen of Heaven course, which what you have is probably the revised version that we did just a couple of years ago. But the original came out, well, we worked on it in 80, 81, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was so controversial and so scary for a lot of people, that it took until 1986 to get the denomination to really publish it.
So why was that? Can you explain why was it so scary? I mean, I know it was groundbreaking, but...
Well, you know, at that time, if you mentioned women's issues or history or any of that, you were angry at men. That's what it meant.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept going through the stuff and looking to see, and I wasn't particularly angry. I have two wonderful sons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't that men. I was wanting to reclaim this this history and all of it. But, you know, that was one of the complaints. It was too angry. It was all for women, and there was nothing about men, and there was, you know,
that's the point.
Anyway, and there was just a kind of scariness about it. But there was another woman on the staff in Boston who took over after the other one had left the job, and she had credibility. She was a very distinguished-looking New England woman. Everybody loved her, and she was determined that this was going to get published, and she really pushed it. And because she was so well-liked and had such credibility, I think it wouldn't have happened without her.
Well, good thing for that.
After 3 or 4 years, I thought, well, you know, they're never going to publish it.
So how many years did it take for it to actually get published?
Five.
We finished it
in 1 year. It did take a while to get permission to use all the pictures. So that took a while. But, you know, that wouldn't have taken 5 years except for the wariness about it. And of course, as soon as it got out, the women just gobbled it up. It was, you know, just what everybody was longing for.
Right. So, well, I can see why. And anybody who takes the course, it's a 13-week course. And the way we teach it is you don't have to take every course. But you know what? Almost every woman has. You know, and the way it's so brilliantly done, because you have left brain and right brain stuff. You know, it's a little bit of ritual, a little bit of, you know, academia. The PowerPoint presentations are just wonderful. And I can't say enough about it. It's fantastic.
By the way, I just found in my stuff here the name of the woman rabbi who did that workshop on Sarah. Her name is Susan Talvey.
Okay. Susan Talvey.
I don't know if she's still around, but...
Well, thank you, Susan Talvey. That was a great idea.
It was a great idea. It has worked wonderfully in every group.
Well, and you know, and I think you know, every March, women lament the fact of, you know, for Women's History Month, that you know, women's history is so lacking, and you know, the female gender's history has so many gaping holes in it, and you know, this helps. Helps that problem a little bit. I mean, at least, you know, from a spiritual point of view.
That's what we hoped that it would do. That I certainly hoped that we'd get some of that information out there, and in a way that women could understand it and open the way for them to study more if they wanted to.
Yeah, and your resource list is just is really just wonderful. Well, and because, you know, like I think you've said, you know, it's the winners who write and edit history.
There's
so much we don't know. And I don't know about you, but, you know, just this whole idea of what's been swept under the rug that so many people don't even know about. I mean, look, I grew up in New Orleans, the Bible Belt. I didn't know about any of this till I moved to California. And the thought that I would have gone my entire life without knowing any of this.
Exactly.
You know,
that's exactly how I felt.
I was so angry. You know, I have to admit, I went through a really angry phase. You know, not that I hated men or anything like that, but I just felt duped, you know. And I thought, you know what, how could this be? This just is not right. And, you know, and here you have what's going on at Texas State Board of Education. We got the rewriting of history again, you know.
Right.
And
well,
it never ends. We don't learn.
Yeah. And we need, as women, to be very aware and that we get our history into the required curriculum.
Well, you know, I think some of the other powerful things in here are one of those affirmations that if the gods changed once, they can change again. You know, and
that's right. That's right. You know, I was influenced early in my life by liberal religion, because that's where my parents were. And one of the books I read when I was in high school, I think, was by Harry Emerson Fosdick, and his whole thesis was that the ancient Hebrew people, their concept of God changed over the centuries. Started out to be to be one kind of God, and gradually evolved into another and another. And that kind of stayed with me. And when I was putting Cakes for the Queen of Heaven together, and I read Naomi Goldenberg, she raised the question, well, in fact, she said, I think, in her part of her book, she said, well, if women become priests and ministers and rabbis, this male God won't fit in anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't help thinking of, you know, that whole notion that the gods do change. And what happens is they reflect the changes in society, and then society reflects the changes in the mythology. So it's one of those principles that I learned when I was researching, that the mythology in a culture reflects its social arrangements.
Yeah, I think you phrased it something like if it reflects a male god and male leaders, well, then that's the kind of society you're going to get.
Exactly. So if you look back and you look at the ancient world, and here are all these wonderful mythologies about powerful goddesses, what does that tell you? It says, well, maybe women had some power in that society.
Mm-hmm.
You see? And so I kind of took that and reapplied it. And I think it was an important idea to follow through on.
No, I do too. I mean, the whole course is so liberating. I mean, just it liberates our entire mind, you know, our entire outlook. And I know, I think another part of the curriculum that I impress on the students is that timeline. I say, ladies, burn this timeline into your brain, you know, because look at the blip on the screen of this Judeo-Christian God, and look at, you know, look how enduring goddess was for countless years before that.
Yeah.
And, and they sort of just look at it with their mouths open, because you know what? They didn't really realize it.
That's right. And it keeps going even further back. You know, it's just an amazing piece of information that we go back that far with goddesses.
Right. Well, so Shirley, let me ask you, I have to, and you know, some of these things, you know, might be out of left field, so if any of these questions feel uncomfortable, just say so. But I have to ask you, if you don't mind commenting, what do you think about Sarah Palin saying she's a feminist and her mama grizzlies? Have you seen that in the news?
Yes, I just heard that on the news. And well, I think that in the sense of getting out there and doing her own thing, okay, you could call that feminist if you want, but I think she's also a very patriarchal woman in many ways, and her views are very patriarchal. But I like the idea of the Mama Grizzlies. I mean, I think she's absolutely right about that.
Well, yeah, I like that idea, too, but I don't think she really knows what a feminist is, quite frankly.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I don't think she's... anything that we might call a feminist, but I think she has a family, she is out there doing something of her own, so in that sense I'd have to say she's a strong woman. I disagree with her on almost everything, but but you know, that's her right. And
absolutely. And let me ask you too, you know, when you were doing this cakes, did you find that it was well received? I mean, was there backlash to it, and was it
yes and no. the women who in the congregations who formed groups and used the course absolutely loved it. For the most part. However, there were many men and some women who challenged, you know, said, well, who are these so-called scholars? And there are other scholars who say things that are different and so forth. So there were challenges to it. And I answered that. I remember we had a workshop at General Assembly shortly after it came out, and the following year, I think, where there was, you know, there were people who really wanted to attack it. And but many, many women showed up for this workshop and who had taken the class. But the, but as far as the scholars, I should mention that, you know, there was this, well, this scholar doesn't agree with what you're saying here and this one, you know. And I said back to them, I only used highly regarded scholars, ones with outstanding reputations. What I had learned in all my going to school and studying in different fields was that several scholars in a field may look at the same data, say the same archaeological artifacts or the same scripture or whatever they're studying, and come out with, say, three scholars, all very distinguished, and come out with three entirely different interpretations.
Absolutely. Look at Chateau Hayuk, Maria Gimbutas, Mellert, and Ian Hodder now.
Exactly. And so I said, I just, I learned from that I could pick the scholar that I liked. And I could say, and I do through the book, the course, there are other scholars who say other things, but this is a distinguished scholar, and this is what he or she says.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how. And there was no really good argument against that. You know, that really kind of settled it for people. It was, you know, and I would say, you want to argue with Joseph Campbell? Be my guest. You know, go ahead.
That was good. I like that.
And,
especially since Joseph Campbell's so well known and so loved.
Exactly. And so are most of the other people.
Well, I know whenever people want to trash Maria Gimbutas, I usually say, look, Joseph Campbell said her work was the Rosetta, you know, was like a Rosetta Stone. You know,
exactly.
So sorry.
Well, that's it. And there are people who disagree with her interpretations, and I say the same thing back to them. You know, she's a distinguished scholar. I like what she says. If you want to argue with her, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, and you know what? And people do that every day. You know, people do that every day. So why wasn't it, you know, why shouldn't you have done the same thing? You know, I run into that all the time, too, when I'm out giving lectures. You know, I run into, well, the Bible doesn't oppress women. What are you talking about?
Uh-huh.
And I'll say, well, haven't you read it? You know, kind of as gently as possible and, you know, point out different things. And you know, and they do always go back to this idea that, you know, if you're into this stuff, you must hate men. You know, and I say, look, I have been married to a wonderful man for 25 years. I love men, but this is all reality too. It doesn't mean we hate men. We just want some balance and some partnership, and you know, we want some equality.
Yeah, and it's. But initially, years back, it was very hard to argue that. I mean, it was a constant challenge too.
Well, and remember, there was a time women couldn't wear pants either.
Yeah, that's right.
Everything changes.
Yeah.
So did you get support from the pagan community, and is there appeal in the pagan community for this?
Oh, yes. In fact, do you know about Zee Budapest?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Well, I met her a few times. Paths crossed, one thing and another. And she knew about Cakes for the Queen of Heaven, and she called me at one point. I don't know how many years back this was, probably sometime in the 90s. And she said, you know, I get a lot of phone calls asking for if I don't have a course in women's spirituality. And she said, I know you've written this course, and she had seen it. And she said, would it be all right if I recommended it? I said, of course, you know.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I don't know how much of that she did or if any of the people she recommended to ever sent for it, but probably some did. I know that it got out beyond our denomination because I have heard that there are some now chapters who have used it, and other denominations, women's groups have picked it up, and the pagan groups, you're right. We have in the denomination a strong contingent of people who are very interested in earth-based spiritualities and pagan rituals and so forth. And so many of our congregations have a group devoted to that and doing solstice and equinox rituals and so forth.
Well, and I think that's good, too, because I think, unfortunately, what happens too much in the pagan community is, you know, you get the focus on certain things, and you don't really know this history. So there's not this real solid foundation for what it's really all about, in a sense. And I think this just really enriches the whole pagan, I don't know, ideology, in a sense.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
because
one of the wonderful things that's happened in many of our congregations is that the women, the older women, have decided to create crone rituals so that becoming an older woman, a woman of wisdom and power, you know, taking the word crone and making it into a positive has
mm-hmm.
been a very popular thing to do. And in fact, I'm planning such a ritual with the women here for, I think it's next week sometime, and because there are some women who would really like to acknowledge their age and their wisdom, and they want to be crones. So.
Well, and that's wonderful. You know, I mean, I think there's so much work we have to do to make this society healthy. And you know, I talk all the time about, you know, these are new ideals. You know, for women to uplift themselves, for our society to be more sustainable. You know, I look at it and I go, you know what, this is a no-brainer. You know, and unless you are making money hand over fist and somehow benefiting from the structure in place right now, how could you not think this is a good thing? You know, I don't know.
The other thing is that I think that when we began to look into these ancient goddess religions and many of the rituals, they were all very focused on the earth, the cosmos, the moon, and we badly need to reconnect with the earth and not to be exploiting it to death, but honoring its life-sustaining support systems and that kind of thing. And I think a lot of the interest in pagan or earth-based spirituality, it comes from our concern about the earth today.
Well, I think that's why the movie Avatar was so popular, because I think it really tapped into what you just said, as well as, you know, making people rethink everything, you know, greed, exploitation, you know, everything we see going on the nightly news.
Yeah, and it's being dramatized now with this horrible oil mess in the Gulf of Mexico. And I think that was one of the results of so many women looking into these ancient religions. I should mention, too, that it came out clearly in the other course that Elizabeth Fisher wrote called Rise Up and Call Her Name. She, one of the criticisms of Cakes for the Queen of Heaven after a while was, yes, but that's only our Western tradition. What about the rest of the world? And,
mm-hmm.
and Liz Fisher decided to take on the rest of the world and put together, she did a tremendous amount of research and put together a wonderful course in which she really explored women's role in many traditions, many indigenous traditions around the world. And what she found was that there were many, many traditions where women either had been or still were being honored, and so was the earth. And so that's a fascinating course, too. And it covers, you know, much of the rest of the world.
Well, that's going to be my challenge for next year. I think that's going to be the, you know, the course I'll probably teach down at the Goddess Temple next year.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to that because I've certainly enjoyed, you know, the cakes for the Queen of Heaven, most definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me ask you, Shirley. You've obviously, you know, been around a while and have seen things come and go. Do you have hope that we're moving in a good direction? You know, I mean, you know, just sort of tell me your thoughts, you know, from where we've come to where we are. You know, do you sort of have a sense of, you know, I don't know, I think you know what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah, I'm of two minds. I some days I get very cynical and discouraged by some of the things that are still happening, like the oil spill and our pathetic efforts to take care of it. But on other days, what I'm aware of is a whole new way of looking at the world and the cosmos, the universe, emerging. And there are other people writing about this. There's a book by David Corton called The Great Turning, in which he's very optimistic that we're on the edge on about to turn, the Great Turning, he calls it.
Does it have something to do with the 2012 or no?
No, it has to do with the whole notion that, what he called, the subtitle is From Empire to Earth Community, that we are going, there are enough people now committed to going from this whole patriarchal conquer and, empire kind of attitude, toward a more earth-honoring and more egalitarian way of life. He's very optimistic about it. What I see, have seen in my own travels, is that the picture of the Earth taken from space, which we didn't have until the astronauts went up there and took the pictures, crops up in very interesting places. I went into a small Episcopal church, and it was built into the front of their pulpit. Not tacked on, but actually built in on the wood and framed. And then I also went 2 years ago to a Unitarian Universalist International Women's Conference. We had women there from I don't know how many countries all around the world. And this was a, you know, a conference on women and religion. And the two great big monitors in the room where everybody came together, what they had on them most of the time was that image of the Earth taken from space.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, wow, you know, that really is a new icon. And through that whole long weekend, there was almost no traditional language, religious language used. It was all, you know, it was very reverent. It was very awe-inspiring, but it was not any of the traditional verbiage that has come down to us, or very little anyway. And I thought, I was really impressed that at least this group of women that gathered, I suppose there must have been 500 or so, 600 or so, had moved to that kind of an understanding of what spirituality and religion was for them.
Mm-hmm.
So that made me way more hopeful, you know, than listening to the news.
Yeah,
that's with the Corton book. That's the same kind of thing. There are these hopeful signs because we really do need to perceive things from a different perspective, I think. And we haven't had that picture in past generations. There's a song called Blue Boat Home that couldn't have been written until we had those images. And I keep saying to our singers and songwriters, you're spelling out a new religion. You may not realize it, but you're putting into words a new language of reverence.
And so what is blue? Did you say Blue Boat Home?
Yeah, it's the earth.
Oh, it's the earth. Okay, okay. Yeah. Oh, so we're sort of coming back to our roots, in a sense,
yes,
I guess, pun intended.
But we're out in space looking at it. You know,
right.
It's like we haven't had that view of it before or of how it relates to the rest of the universe. And I think all of that, I'm not a scientist, but I think all of that is really exciting and awe-inspiring. And the notion that of our size compared to the size of the universe, all of that is creating a whole new way of looking at ourselves and the earth and the universe.
Well, and I'm wondering, too, you know, we see all of these negative images on TV that makes us feel hopeless. I wonder if that isn't almost an either a conscious or unconscious attempt to make us feel like things will never change. So that would make a lot of us not even try.
Well, I don't know,
maybe I'm giving them too much credit.
Well, you can get to feeling very helpless, like, you know, what in the world can I do about this, you know, kind of thing. But we can do things, and I think many people feel that we are, and it doesn't feel like it's a big thing yet, but it will. Is the hopeful view.
And well, I hope I see it in my lifetime.
Most days I buy into that, but some days I get depressed too.
No, I know what you mean. I mean, some days I'm very hopeful. I'll see these glimmers of hope that make me think, you know what, we're almost there. It's that 100th monkey thing, you know, just
right.
A little bit more of a push. And then other days, but, you know, even looking at this Gulf spill in Katrina and you know, I don't know. It just feels like I'm from that region, New Orleans, and after Katrina, after this, I mean, I wrote about that region sort of having the essence of goddess, you know, at least in my mind, you know, the essence of the people, the melting pot of all the cultures, the flora, the fauna, everything. And it's almost like I'm using a Christian term, but it's almost been like it's almost a sacrificial lamb to expose so much that's wrong with, you know, how our politics and our government and everything is structured, you know. It's almost like, you know, they have suffered for, you know, for the greed and the ineptitude and the callousness and, you know, the haves versus the have-nots. And I don't know, I just wonder if, unfortunately, you know, they always say you have to really hit bottom before you come back up. You know, maybe it's only pragmatic that things have to get really bad before we can expect things to change.
Yeah, I find myself thinking that way too. and that area, I lived in Mobile, Alabama for a couple of years, and I used to drive over to New Orleans once a month to meet with a cluster of ministers, and we would go, you know, to a different wonderful restaurant each time. And those beautiful Gulf Coast beaches over in Alabama, Gulf Shores.
Mm-hmm.
Just think of them being spoiled with all of this mess.
Well, you know, I don't know about you, but I'm waiting for some peaceful protests in the street. I just can't imagine why people are not in the street yet. But, you know, maybe it will still come. Or the way things are, you know, the media wouldn't cover it. They're more interested in covering the tea baggers. I don't know.
Yeah, right.
Well, Shirley, if you were going to do this over again, the cakes, would there be anything you'd do different, or
I just did it over again, you know,
a couple
of years ago. See, it came out in 1986, and by 2006, it was 20 years old, and the Unitarian Universalist Association, it was out of print. They didn't have any more copies of it. And so, but the office in Boston, the women's organization, emailed me and said, look, we keep getting requests for it, and what shall we do? You know, and people would call me, and I would, you know, make Xerox copies of it and that sort of thing. But so we decided to revise and update it. And so that's what you have if you've ordered it this year, is the revised and updated version. But I'll tell you a story about the original course. About 10 years after it was out, I decided to translate some of it into a book. And there was a woman in my congregation who had just started, opened up her own publishing business. And she really wanted to do it, so because she had taken the class, and she really wanted to publish it. And so we agreed to do it. And so I wrote it out. What I did was I made a chapter out of each session, basically, just wrote a chapter about it. Anyway, and I sent it to her, and then, because I had moved away by that time, and she called me and she said, well, it's fine, but you've got to add two more chapters. And I said, on what? And she said, one on sex and one on money. And I looked through it and I realized, you know, of all the issues for women about power, you know, and those two things were not there.
So that would be what you would add.
Yeah, so in the book there I did add the two chapters, and then when I came to revise the course, I said, okay, we've got to not add whole sessions maybe, but we've got to include these concerns, because that was just a big glaring my part.
Well, but you did a wonderful job. So nobody's gonna beat you up for forgetting that. I'm gonna switch phones here because my battery is going a little I would ask you though about the Mary Magdalene chapter. Were you tempted to put any of the ideas of like the Margaret Starbird work that that Mary Magdalene may have been Jesus's wife and the bloodline and all of that, or did you feel like, you know, there just wasn't enough evidence for it?
I thought that it was more important to us as women that she may have been, or probably was, an apostle than that she might have been his wife. You know, I didn't want to go there. I thought, okay, you know, that's okay if scholars want to speculate on it, but I think it's really more important. And according to Elaine Pagels, another one of my distinguished scholars, her belief was that she was indeed not only an apostle, but the chief apostle.
Yeah.
The one that knew him best and all of that.
Right.
Whether they had any kind of sexual relationship, who knows. But it was more important to me to see her as an apostle, and that might be more of an empowerment to women.
Right, right. Because we've lost that idea.
Go with that whole thing about maybe she was married to him.
Yeah, because we've lost that whole idea of, you know, women leaders in the church.
Right.
I mean, that's
right.
All gotten squashed. Well, Shirley, is there anything you'd like to add that I have maybe failed to ask you?
Oh, no, I don't think so.
Okay.
Is there anything else you wanted to ask about any of the sessions?
Well, you know, I'm getting ready to do the Mary Magdalene one Saturday, quite interestingly, and I'm team teaching it with Joan Norton, who has written the Mary Magdalene Within. And she actually has an interesting idea about the, Gnosticism being a little bit too left-brained and not allowing enough of a connection with the body. So I'm going to,
I think from what I've read, that's probably true, too. It was very abstract and,
So we're just going to throw that in, too, so that, you know, women sort of have I have to admit, every class, it seems like it would coincide with something from the headlines. And so, I would supplement all the classes with things that are going on in the world, that would sort of reflect, what was actually happening. So it's been a lot of fun. And
there's one other thing I would say. Before I started revising and updating, we tried to get as many women as possible, especially young women, to answer some survey questions about just very simple, what is the most important issue for you or concern for you in your personal life, and what is the most important concern you have globally or, beyond yourself? And all the other issues of body image and all of the stuff that are still issues were there, but the one that got the most, the heaviest mention was balance, that women were looking for some kind of balance in their personal lives.
You mean we're expected to do too much?
Yes, yeah, and that had not been the main concern years back, So I tried to bring that in here and there in updating. And, of course, the global one was peace.
And that's the last one, isn't it?
Well, it's the last of the first session, I think, at least.
Okay.
The one on that ends part one, I think, has to do with that. But,
okay.
Yeah. But those were the two things that the young women today said.
Well, I have to tell you, I wish there was some way for the UU Church or you or somebody. I mean, we've been talking about it amongst ourselves because this has been so. I get so many emails because, I'll send out emails and I'll say, okay, this week is such and such class. And you know how emails tend to bounce all over the country. People will write me and say, I'm not in Los Angeles. How can I take it? And I'll say, well, do you have a UU church in your area? And they say no. And they say, well, can't you put these online? And I guess I just wondered, have you ever thought about putting these online? Because, there's so many women in all of these nooks and crannies of the world. I mean, I know they listen to my radio show, and they'll call me and they'll say, they'll email me and they'll say, Karen, your show's my lifeline, because I'm surrounded,
I think it could be done, and I think it would be a wonderful idea. I hadn't thought about it. Well, I'm old. I'm not that computer-oriented as think as much as some of the younger women, but I do think it would be a great idea because that's how an awful lot of education is happening today.
Yeah. Well, I know some people, and here in L.A., it seems to have started a resurgence, I started, teaching the classes down in Irvine in Southern California, and now other women are starting to pick it up and, teaching it in their little part of L.A., and I'm thrilled. Because I figure, look, I wish every woman could be exposed to this. It would change the world.
Well, I'm just delighted that it's out there. And I got an email the other day saying that someone in the Netherlands had translated the whole thing into Dutch, and they were using it there. So,
well, you must feel really proud about this. You should.
But I like the idea of an online course. I'm not sure. I would have to get one of my daughters or somebody to help me figure out how to do it.
Yeah. Well, there are enough of these there are these teleconference companies already on the internet that you can go to have these teleconference calls. And I think it's as simple as you call in and the people who are interested call in, and it's like one big conference call. Now, I haven't actually taught a class that way yet. But I know, I think you've actually heard from a friend of mine who contacted you about doing them online, and she's getting ready to start trying to teach the first session. So we'll have to give you feedback and let you know how that goes.
Well, I was thinking, about having it. I know that some of the graduate schools are offering courses on the computer.
Mm-hmm.
So you get together that way. And I don't see why it couldn't be adapted for that kind of use.
Well, I would really love to see that happen.
Yeah, because you need the pictures.
They're
sort of the heart and soul of it.
And I wonder, too, I guess, I was just a little bit concerned about the permission to use the pictures like that. That was one of the things that sort of held me back from actually, moving forward to put it online myself.
Yeah, and that, I think, the whole business of copyright and so forth online is really fuzzy. I think even the specialists in it aren't real clear about it. But I'm sure that it could be done some way. And actually, we got most of those pictures that are in the course. In the original course, we had to write and get permission from museums and I don't know what all in order to use the pictures. But the woman who did most of that gathering the pictures for the revised edition said that she got most of it free off the internet.
Wow, well that's pretty good.
Yeah.
Well, so we will have to keep in touch.
If that's the case, then it seems to me we should be able to do the course online.
Well, it would be so valuable to put it online because, even in big cities, it seems like, it's not that hard to teach, but it seems to some women it appears to be daunting. And, maybe it's not being taught at, as many UU churches as it could be. So the online option would be wonderful.
Yeah, I think so. Well, we'll have to work on it.
Okay. Well,
retirement project.
There you go. So what do you have planned ahead, Shirley? You've already made a wonderful contribution, but you strike me as the type of lady that you're not done yet.
Well, I do have a book in mind that I've been trying to write, and on what we were just talking about a whole new view of what religion is about, particularly feminist theology. And anyway, I'm hoping to get that together and get it done.
And if any of our listeners wanted to get in touch with you, is the website you gave me here your
You can use that, or you can go to the Women and Religion website.
I have that right here. It's www.uuwr.org. So that's UU for Unitarian Universalist, WR for Women Religion. org. And you can, for listeners who might want to go online and actually buy the course and teach it, I believe it was only about $70.
It's $40 for each piece, part one and then $40 for part two.
So okay. Yeah, you can actually go online and buy it, and you get the workbook. And I have to tell you, don't be discouraged because it was so wonderful. You tell the teacher what to do from the opening of the class to the closing. So you've taken all the hard work out of it.
Well, hopefully. Didn't want to overstructure it because I know that sometimes people were good at facilitating and teaching, they want to do their own thing with it. So,
right. Well, you can do that. I mean, I've been doing that, but if you're, maybe you're a little bit tentative, you can jump in with this. And
I have at least a plan that you can.
Yeah, you have the plan laid out right there for you, and you don't have to do a ton of research, and you can just jump right in. It's wonderful.
Well, Shirley.
I did, and I am, and I'm going to continue to tout it because I think it's so very important. So thank you so very much for the incredible contribution you make to women everywhere with this, and I'm not exaggerating. I really mean that.
Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed talking with you.
And thank you so much for your time.
Oh, you're welcome. And maybe our paths will cross one of these days.
I hope so. And have a glorious retirement. And I know it'll be creative and productive, but get some rest too.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
All right. Well, good night, Shirley.
Good night.
Well, if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss Goddess, the Divine Feminine, and the resurging interest in right brain thinking and the feminine consciousness, whether the great she be deity, archetype, or ideal, and how these new values and benchmarks just will save the world. And our guest tonight was Reverend Shirley Rank, who we owe a huge debt of gratitude to for writing the Cakes for the Queen of Heaven Feminist Theology Curriculum. And if you have a UU church in your area, give them a call. Ask them to teach it. And you know what? If they won't teach it, you teach it because you can. And if that's not possible, email me because I know a woman doing an online classes soon, and I'll put you in touch with her. And I'm also teaching the latter part of Session 2 at the Goddess Temple in Orange County through the end of July. You can catch the last of these classes. I'm also thinking of starting them up again and opening the class potentially to men and women in the Venice area. So if that sounds like something you're interested in, let me hear from you because I may do it based on interest. Well, I am going to take a break here and for just about 50 seconds, and while I'm gone, I'm going to let you listen to I Am Goddess by Lisa Thiel, and when I come back in less than a minute, we're going to get into our What's the Buzz topic for tonight, so please stay with me. By talking to you about the movie that's out in Los Angeles and New York right now called Agora. And Agora is the movie about the astronomer and philosopher Hypatia, a woman who lived in Alexandria, I think around 391 AD, something like that. And if you're in New York or L.A., definitely go see this movie. It only just came to the United States this year, and I found out why that is when I attended the question and answer session after the movie last week, because it seems that distributors were afraid of this movie, and that's the word they used, afraid of this movie. Well, if you watch it, you will understand why, because this was a very, very ugly time for Christianity. It was a time when the Christians were killing off the pagans, and then they turned around and turned on the Jews, and then they turned on each other. And Hypatia was a pagan at the time, and you know, her only religion was science. And she seemed like she was brilliant for her time, and she just didn't like the divisiveness of the religion because she could see how it was causing death and destruction, and that was too political then. The bishop, the Christian bishop Cyril, thought she was too dangerous and had her killed for being a witch. And although they don't actually show her death, the real way it occurred, which was her skin was peeled from her body using shells and tiles, she does meet a tragic end in the movie. But I think it's really important to see this movie because it speaks so much about the dangers of religion even today. Things have not changed that much. And the sets were beautiful. They filmed it in Malta, and the Serapeum Library, which was the daughter library of the great Library of Alexandria, was where this was filmed. The sets were luscious. They were just incredible. And I would say support this movie. And you may see on some Christian blogs that, you know, this was just a fabrication and none of these things really happened. And some priests are actually saying that there's no historical fact to any of this. And one of the examples they use to try to make that point is Julius Caesar burned down the Library of Alexandria. So this couldn't possibly be real. This is just made up. This is Christian bashing. Well, they just have their facts wrong, because many scholars believe that the Library of Alexandria was not totally burned down by Julius Caesar. They think potentially only a small part of it. And besides, there was this daughter library at the Temple of Serapis, and that's where this film was actually set, at the Serapeum Library. And it is just so tragic to see this wonderful library being overrun, you know, by these Christians who had just no regard for the wisdom of the ages. It was really hard to watch on some levels, but I think it's important that we all watch. And it is supposed to be opening up nationally very soon. At first, it was only going to open in Los Angeles and New York, but it has met with such critical acclaim, and so many people have been clamoring for it. They did say it was going to open nationally, so watch for it, and I don't think you'll be disappointed. Let's see, the next item on the What's the Buzz, hard to say, but, you know, we are about reality here. It's hard to watch the images of these poor birds soaked in oil on the Gulf Coast. I've actually gotten to the point where I can't look because my body just hurts all over, and I want to cry when I see them. And then when I read something like this, it makes me feel even worse, because at least you think, well, you know, they're saving some of them, you know. Well, I don't think that that's always turns out really well, because this is what it says in the Daily Beast. It says, people who glimpsed the horrifying photos of oil-soaked birds last week at least took comfort in the fact that the birds were supposedly saved. However, a German biologist, Sylvia Goss, is recommending that the birds be euthanized rather than cleaned and released. According to serious studies, the middle-term survival rate of oil-soaked birds is under 1%. He says, we therefore oppose cleaning the birds. He says, the capturing and cleaning of the birds leads to fatal amounts of stress, and forcing the birds to ingest coal solutions or Pepto-Bismol in order to combat the oil's poisons often just leads to fatal kidney and liver damage. Goss worked in the 1998 cleanup effort after the Pallas oil spill in the North Sea. The World Wildlife Fund agrees with Goss's recommendation, saying birds, those who have been covered in oil, can still be caught, can no longer be helped. Therefore, the World Wildlife Fund is very reluctant to recommend cleaning. So, unfortunately, that's some bad news for the birds. Let's hope they're wrong, but I don't know. Then also in the Daily Beast, on their column called The Cheat Sheet, just a little quickie here, I thought this was interesting. The question was posed, do lesbians make better moms? And the article from U.S. News and World Report that the Daily Beast picked up says, contrary to what the religious right may say, children raised by lesbian parents are doing just as well as their peers, according to a new report based on a 20-year study to be published in the journal Pediatrics. In fact, they may even be better off. And Nanette Gantrell, the study's author, said, when we compared the adolescents in our study to the so-called gold standard, we found the teens with lesbian mothers were actually doing better. Researchers found that the children showed significantly fewer social problems and rated much higher academically and socially. As for why their children are faring well, Gantrell suggested that lesbian mothers, quote, are very committed, very involved parents, unquote, and may also be better off economically. So there's that good news. And I don't know how many of you know who Cardinal Mahony is. Well, he was a cardinal here in Los Angeles who built the big, monstrosity cathedral. Some people call it Our Lady of the Angels. Tore down a really beautiful old church and built this very cold, contemporary structure and spent millions and millions and millions of dollars, and he wasn't real popular here for that because a lot of people looked at it as he was just leaving something for his legacy, you know, that this was about his ego. So those of us who felt that way are not sorry to hear that he may actually face federal indictment for his involvement in the pedophile priest cover-ups. According to this article by Micah Stone in the Portland Humanist Examiner, federal prosecutors are weighing charges of conspiracy, obstruction, and perjury against Cardinal Roger Mahony. From a flood of evidence released from church files, a disturbing picture is emerging, a picture that implicates Cardinal Mahony in the cover-up of rampant child sexual abuse within the Archdiocese of Los Angeles. So we're going to be following that story to see what happens. And people were not happy with him about that either, as you might imagine. And Maureen Dowd, one of my favorite columnists, she had an article in the New York Times called Dress to Distract. And it was about this woman who was fired from Citibank for looking too sexy. That's what I was referring to at the top of the hour when I said, or the virtue police stalking the halls of the Chrysler Center. I'm going to read you some little excerpts from this. I think you'll find it interesting. Maureen Dowd says, it's hard to feel sorry for a woman who frets about being too beautiful. Ordinarily in life, extraordinarily good looks are an advantage for men and women and even babies. Not only do babies gaze longer at more comely adult faces, research tells us, but parents may gaze longer at more comely babies. A research team at the University of Alberta conducted a study at a supermarket and observed that parents gave more attention and supervision to their pretty little ducklings. Aesthetic allure is evolutionary after all. Like lots of animals, said Dr. Andrew Harrell, the team leader, we tend to parcel out our resources on the basis of value. So it was unusual when a knockout in New York, her name is Deborah Lee Lorenzana, 33-year-old single mother, filed suit against Citicorp, complaining she was fired in August from the Citibank branch at the Chrysler Center for looking too sexy. Plaintiff was advised that as a result of the shape of her figure, her lawsuit reads, such clothes were purportedly too distracting for her male colleagues and supervisors to bear. Poor guys. Late-night comedians and tabloids have had a field day. She flaunted her assets, punned the New York Daily Times News. Last week's Village Voice cover profile of Lorenzana, who grew up in Puerto Rico and moved to New York when she was 21, raved about the bank officer's charms. They say at 5'6" and 125 pounds with soft eyes and flawless bronze skin, she is J-Lo curves meets Jessica Simpson's rack meets Audrey Hepburn elegance. TV and tabloids ran pictures taken by a photographer who works with her lawyer showing Lorenzana in the pencil skirts, turtlenecks, tailored jackets, and stilettos that she said made her bosses at the bank concentrate on the wrong kind of figures. She has to manage her wardrobe so these men can manage their libidos, said her lawyer. Jack Tuckner, adding that her lawyer is Jack Tuckner, he said, adding that her bosses acted as immaturely as the boys on Wayne's World. Sure sounds like it. Well, we'll be following this story as well. I guess guys over at the Chrysler Building are going to dress their women in burkas next. Okay, and speaking of burkas, we're going to talk a little bit about what's happening in the Middle East and in, to women and girls in Muslim countries. Apparently, CNN.com is letting us know that 16 girls are sick and suspected poisonings in Afghanistan. They're recuperating in a hospital after they were poisoned and lost consciousness during school on Tuesday. The attack is another in a string of suspected poisonings that have targeted schoolgirls in recent months in Afghanistan. This latest case happened at the Gaharshawa Begum, sorry, I can't pronounce Afghan, primary school. And the police had detained groundskeepers at the school and checked the water supply to see if that's where the poisoning occurred. This attack comes after at least 88 girls and teachers became ill in separate cases at three girls' schools in the Kunduz province in late April. The Taliban was suspected in those cases, authorities said at the time. Girls were not allowed to attend school during the Taliban's rule in that area, and since girls' schools began reopening after the Taliban was overthrown in 2001, the facilities and the female students have been the victims of attacks. You know I don't live in that culture, but I have to wonder what is wrong with men that are so afraid to have women educated. You know, it just really bugs me. As does this next story from AOL News, seems Saudi clerics are advocating adult breastfeeding. Okay? Just when you think you've heard it all, women in Saudi Arabia should give their breast milk to male colleagues and acquaintances in order to avoid breaking strict Islamic law forbidding mixing between the sexes, two powerful Saudi clerics have said. They are at odds, however, over precisely how the milk should be conveyed. A fatwa issued recently about adult breastfeeding to establish maternal relations and preclude the possibility of sexual contact has resulted in a week's worth of newspaper headlines in Saudi Arabia. Some have found the debate so bizarre that they're calling for stricter regulations about how and when fatwas should be issued. Sheikh Al Obeikan, an advisor to the royal court and consultant to the Ministry of Justice, set off a firestorm of controversy recently when he said on TV that women should come into regular contact, that women who come into regular contact with men who aren't related to them ought to give them their breast milk so they will be considered relatives. I mean, what a woman has to do to just be in the company of a man who's not her relative? Is this absurd? He says, the man should take the milk, but not directly from the breast of the woman. He should drink it, and then he automatically becomes a relative of the family, a fact that allows him to come in contact with women without breaking Islam's rules about mixing. Well, you know what? How about just changing Islam's rules about mixing? This is insane. We have girls being poisoned in school. We have women being buried up to their neck and stoned after they've been raped. Now we have this. I mean, what's next? There's more to the article, but it's not worth reading. It just, you know, points more to the absurdity of, you know, and the suffering and oppression of women in these male-dominated religions. So, let's see, what's next? Okay, I think our final item tonight goes back to what we talked about last week a little bit, the red spiral door idea that was sort of burning up Facebook. Well, I have a comment from someone who wrote me that I think you'll enjoy. Kat Clifford liked the idea of the red spiral dance and actually went out to, let's see, where was he? I think he was on Coney Island. And let's see, she describes what she did out there. She says, I was spontaneously drawing a circle in the sand. I had no magical tools, so I consecrated a seashell on the spot and used it as a makeshift athami of sorts. I had no specific objects or purpose in mind when I began other than to make a general puja to my goddesses, meditate, and seek inspiration, guidance, and blessings of intercession in the resolution of my various present dilemmas. I started by inscribing a perfect pentacle within a circle about 4 feet in diameter, and it grew from there, working diacil. I cast a second concentric circle around the first. In the act of this working, I came to realize that this raising was taking on a greater purpose than I had realized, and I became conscious that the circle was being raised to ward against the possibility of the great vomiting of oil touching these beaches. In the space between the first circle and the second, I inscribed my symbols for my 5 goddesses, one at each point of the pentacle, while asking for the boon of their active intervention in protecting my beloved Long Island shoreline against the touch of the encroaching filthy evil perpetrated by the greed of the hated patriarchy, the huge, growing, spreading malignancy on the beautiful blue face of our beloved Gaia. My circle grew, a third concentric circle I added around the first two. This I made in the shape of a great many-petaled lotus. I began to feel the raising. I felt the great indescribable feeling, the bliss. Each time I reached the northernmost point of the circle, I paused and cast my gaze up to the top of the great parachute tower. I began to draw an audience. People watched and sent text messages and took pictures with their phones. My concentric circles were about 25 feet in diameter now. Over and over, I went round, tracing the outline. I was entranced. At some point, I realized I was now working Windershins. My raising had now been applied to banishing. In the space between the second and third circles, I inscribed, "No oil on these beaches, so mote it be. Let this be done correctly and for the good of all." I then dug a shallow trench with my bare hands, a semicircular arc between the circles and the sea. While doing so, I silently repeated the mantra, "Thou shalt not land, thou shalt not land, thou shalt not land." I grabbed 2 handfuls of sand, faced the south, and cried out to the clear blue sky and the dark gray sea, "Let it be so." I threw the sand in the air and slapped the sand of the beach 3 times with my 2 open palms as hard as I could to drop and dispel the power. I collapsed into my beach chair exhausted. I still ache 3 days later, and my heart has been tap dancing irregularly from time to time since. I watch passerby's reaction to the circle. Then, interestingly, a bushy bearded man with brown skin and long curly black hair walked casually and directly into the circle and approached the pentacle at the center. He squatted at its circumference and repeatedly traced over the line of the inscribed pentacle in the air with his finger. He then stood up and left the great circle as simply as he had entered. A cunning man added his own. As I packed up my stuff and started walking around the boardwalk away from the discharged but still earth-etched circles, leaving the transient facade to its fate, as it is the way with beach magic, it occurred to me that a vastly more puissant earth power must be raised and bent to this great task than which I was capable of raising on my own. So there's a little bit more to that, but that was just one person's red spiral dance, and I thank Kat for sending that so I could share it with you. Well, that concludes our What's the Buzz segment for today. And as long as you keep telling me you like this, as long as there are important issues to talk about, I will be the voice for the ideals of the great she. We have to try our best to teach and share ideas that offset negative and toxic attitudes and breed intolerance, hate, war, exclusivity, disharmony, imbalance, injustice. And I will keep reminding you, we have to keep reminding each other, we are each other's cheerleader. We have to keep working to reach that 100th monkey, no matter how hard it seems sometimes, no matter how hopeless. We will shift that paradigm. We will put that morphic feel in motion so change comes, and it will come. Use the steam of Bridget, the tenacity and passion of Sekhmet, and the social justice of Kali to set this in motion. So with that being said, the bees are released from my bonnet for another week. There were the bees. They're gone. So we're going to turn our attention to tonight's evening prayer. That's the cue. And tonight, Kat Clifford sent me a rain of blessings, a prayer, a puja that I'm going to share with you because it is very beautiful. I'm going to skip over announcements and go directly to this evening's prayer. And it is a little bit long, so I invite you to close your eyes and settle in where you're comfortable. And take a deep breath with me and bring an even deeper focus to these words of prayer. Just breathe in and breathe out, in and out. Take a big cleansing breath and let loose, let go anything in there that you want out. Goddesses, hear my puja. I have been guided by the lights, and I have not been led astray. You guide me, comfort me, love me, nurture me, protect me. You keep me on the correct path. I am thy tiny child, eyes filled with wonder at the miraculous demonstrations of thy favor and thy love, manifested as boons, bliss, and prosperity in the lives of your devotees. Thou overarching protections fill me with confidence, and I am serene in the face of chaos. I am lifted and I am upheld. Divine expression flows up through and out of me, expressed joyfully as my unique self, like the light that is rendered into the rainbow by the uniquely shaped prism. I meld with Shakti, the impetus that is the maker within time and the universe. Shakti, she who makes flowerings of beautiful and blissful complexity against the currents of simplification and chaos. Shakti, the divine urge that is distributed uniformly throughout the all of this cycle of creation. Shakti, who is the one goddess of whom all other deities that reside within the great wheel of time are aspects. I am minuscule but infinite, expression of the mother. I am a minuscule but infinite expression of the mother. I worship and give loving thanks to five divinities that gather together and comprise the totality that is her, the principle of the divine feminine. I give thanks to Mother Lilith. You walk with me always. Warm is the sheltering protection of your great and folding gray wings. Fragrant is the scent of your shining jet black hair. Blissful and tender is the love shown in your bright green eyes. Fearful is your dark wrath upon those who violate your devotees. I give thanks to Ma Kali. Bold, fearless, and passionate is your aspect. Potent are your intercessions. Warm is the love that radiates from the banked fires of your divine essence. Wondrous are your boons and the unfoldings of your makings. I give thanks to Maha Sarasvati Ma. Infinitely patient, blissful, and loving is your essence. Illuminating is the gift of knowledge bestowed by you that confers wisdom, sacred and secular. Gentle and unspeakably beautiful is your radiant aspect. Profound and ever proliferating is your elevation of consciousness. I give thanks to Mother Artemis. Joyful and jolly is the hunt you lead. That is the hearty quest of life itself. Bounteous are the blessings of your hearth. Jealous and passionate is your protection of the weak and the vulnerable. Swift and lasting is the pain of the sorrow of your wrath upon those who despoil them. Boundless is your love for your maidens, your mothers, your wise crowns. I give thanks to Great Mother Hecate. You reside above and behind all. All-seeing is your vigilance. Inscrutable and unknowable are your mysteries, shrouded in darkness. Subtle and profound are your ways. Ever attentive are you to the balancing of all things, light and dark, seen and unseen, great and small, sentimental and dispassionate. Thank you for your great blessings, divine mothers who are aspects of the one mother and comprise the great wheel, that is she. As above, so below. Ever devoted, Kat. And I would like to congratulate Kat on the job that she was just able to actually acquire. So congratulations, Kat, on your job. I am certain you were you were divinely helped. And there's reciprocity with the goddess. You give to her and she gives back. I've found that to be the case for years and years. Well, listeners, that is all until next Wednesday. I'd like to say good night, and may the great She embrace you in her golden wings. And as I leave you, I will let you listen to a song by Flash Silverman called Dancing with the Snake.